I was reading this psychology paper the other day, and I came across this concept called the propinquity effect. Have you heard of this?
Vaguely. It sounds like something from a physics textbook, doesn't it?
It does, right.
Yeah.
But it's actually really simple. It's basically just a fancy way of saying that the more time you spend with someone in a physical space, the more likely you are to form a bond with them.
Proximity plus time.
Exactly. And when I read that, I immediately thought, wait a minute. That is literally the definition of the modern workplace.
That's a very polite way of saying we spend more waking hours with our cubicle neighbors than we do with our actual spouses or families.
Right. We're basically running this massive global experiment in propinquity every single day. And, biology doesn't just shut off because you walked through a security gate or logged on to Zoom.
No, it doesn't.
But here's the tension we're exploring today. We are biologically wired to connect. But we work in these legal structures companies that are absolutely terrified of what happens when those connections go wrong.
It's the collision of human messiness and corporate rigidity. And as we'll see, that messiness can get incredibly expensive.
So today we are going on a deep dive into this comprehensive guide from HR Insider called Navigating the Professional and Personal. And I want to be clear right from the start, this isn't about office gossip.
Not at all.
We aren't here to judge who is dating who. This is about the legal, the ethical, and the structural minefield of workplace relationships. Whether you're a manager, an employee with a crush, or just someone trying to survive office politics, this affects you.
And the source material is fascinating because it moves away from that old school, thou shalt not date mentality. It actually argues that trying to completely ban relationships is more dangerous than managing them.
That's a bold claim, and we're going to unpack why. But let's start at the baseline. Because usually when HR gets involved, we assume it's bad news. But the guide actually admits that workplace connections can be a good thing.
It does, and I think that's a really refreshing place to start. The guide acknowledges that, look, these relationships are inevitable. You can't put hundreds of people in a building and expect them to act like robots.
Right.
And in fact, when those connections are just social or supportive, they're hugely beneficial.
The whole work spouse phenomenon.
Precisely. If you look at the data, and the guide points this out, employees who have a best friend at work are significantly more engaged. I think the stat is something like 7 times more likely to be engaged in their job.
7 times.
It's massive. Because think about it. If you like the people you work with, you work harder for them. It builds a support system. In a high-pressure job, having someone who just gets it is a huge stress reliever.
It's retention, basically. You stay for the people.
Exactly. So the source isn't anti-relationship at all. They aren't trying to make us all solitary workers. But, and here's the big pivot, the positive turns problematic not because of the relationship itself, but because of a cognitive bias called the halo effect.
Okay, break that down for us, the halo effect.
Yeah. It's a psychological concept where if you like someone personally, your brain just automatically assumes they're better at everything else, including their job.
Oh, I see.
So if you're close with a coworker dating them, or even just best friends, you might overlook their missed deadlines. You might excuse their bad behavior because, well, they're a good person.
Your affection actually blinds you to their professional flaws.
Correct. And in a business, that is dangerous. It kills objectivity. The guide makes a really specific distinction here. The problem isn't two peers dating in the marketing department who have no influence over each other.
All right.
The problem is the intersection of intimacy and authority.
And that's the core HR challenge, isn't it?
It is. The second one person has influence over the other's career, their pay, schedule, workload, promotions, the relationship becomes a liability.
Which I think leads us right to what the source identifies as the three pillars of risk. And the first one is, well, it's the big one.
The nuclear scenario.
Yeah, exactly. Power imbalances.
Right. And this is the area with by far the highest liability. We're talking about relationships involving reporting lines, a manager, and a direct report.
Or even a senior leader and a junior employee in a totally different department.
Exactly. Now, I want to play devil's advocate here for a second because I think a lot of people listening might be thinking, hey, we're both adults. If it's consensual, why does HR even care? Isn't consent the magic word?
Good question.
In the real world, maybe. In employment law, absolutely not. The guide calls this the consensual myth.
The consensual myth, that sounds ominous.
It is. Because legally, true consent is very, very difficult to prove when one person holds the keys to the other person's livelihood. If your boss asks you out, do you say yes because you really want to?
Or because you're afraid saying no will hurt your performance review next month.
Precisely. And here's a technical legal concept the source brings up that is, frankly, terrifying for companies. Strict liability.
What does that mean in this context?
In a lot of places, if a supervisor harasses a subordinate, the company is automatically liable, strictly liable, whether the company knew about it or not.
Wait, so the company's on the hook even if they had no idea this relationship was happening?
Yes. If a manager abuses that power, the company pays. Mm-hmm. And here's the nightmare scenario for them. The relationship ends. Most do. If it ends badly, the junior employee can retroactively claim it was never really consensual.
That it was quid pro quo, dating the boss to keep the job.
And just like that, a consensual fling becomes a multi-million dollar lawsuit.
Wow.
And it's not just about the couple, it's about the rest of the team. This is the part people always forget. If you and I are on a team and you're dating the boss, I immediately assume the game is rigged.
Even if the boss is being 100% fair.
Perception is reality in management, isn't it? If you get the prime assignment, is it because you're talented? Or is it pillow talk? I stop trusting leadership. The whole culture just rots from the inside out.
So that bleeds right into the second pillar, conflicts of interest. This feels a bit more bureaucratic, maybe, but the guide highlights it as a major area for fraud.
It is. We often think of conflict of interest as just favoritism, but it's actually about asset protection. If you are approving your partner's expense reports or setting their bonus or signing off on their time card,
you're bypassing all the internal controls.
You are. It's basically embezzlement with a heart emoji.
That's a very cynical way to put it.
But it's true. It opens the door to fraud. But, you know, more commonly, it just leads to bad decision making. You cannot effectively critique the work of someone you're sleeping with. You just can't.
The emotional brain overrides the logical brain.
Every time.
So we have power imbalances and conflicts of interest. The third pillar the guy brings up is delicate. They call it external committed relationships.
Right, which is a very polite corporate way of saying affairs.
Yeah. Relationships where one or both people are married or partnered up with someone outside the office. Now, usually this is treated as a moral issue, but the guide is very clear that HR is not the morality police.
And that's a crucial distinction. HR departments generally don't care about the sanctity of your marriage. They're not there to judge your soul. They care about what the guide calls the blast radius.
The blast radius. I like that.
Look, affairs are almost always secret. And secrecy in an organization is like a cancer. It requires deception. It requires using company time and resources to hide your tracks. But the real risk is the volatility.
Meaning if it blows up, it blows up big.
Oh, yeah. If the external partner finds out, I mean, imagine the spouse showing up in the lobby screaming or sending an email to the CEO detailing everything. The disruption is massive.
It's not just awkward. It's a total productivity killer.
We've seen entire departments grind to a halt because of the drama from an exposed affair. People take sides. Rumors fly. Stress-related leave requests suddenly skyrocket. It's a logistical nightmare.
So HR's stance is basically, we don't care who you sleep with, just don't let it tank our Q3 numbers.
Effectively, yes. They're managing the risk of workplace disruption. It's not about morality, it's about operational stability.
This brings up a really interesting point about behavior. The guide talks about professional conduct, but it goes beyond just, you know, PDA.
Mm-hmm.
We all know making out in the break room is bad.
We hope.
But the source talks about something subtler called the zone of exclusion.
Oh, this is a fascinating concept. I'm glad you caught that.
Break it down. What is the zone of exclusion?
It's when a couple, or even just really close friends, create an inside world that excludes everyone else. Think about it. Mm. They go to lunch together every single day. They have inside jokes and meetings that nobody else gets.
Right.
They communicate on Slack in a way that feels private, even in a public channel.
It makes everyone else feel like third wheels in their own office.
Exactly. It kills psychological safety for the rest of the team. It signals, we are the in-group and you are the out-group. And that is just toxic to collaboration.
So, okay, we've painted a pretty terrifying picture here. Liability, fraud, team implosion. So here's the million-dollar question. Why don't companies just ban it? Why not just have a one-sentence policy? No dating allowed, period.
Because of something called reactance theory.
You're just full of psychological terms today.
It's all relevant. Reactance theory basically states that if you threaten a human's freedom, they will fight to get it back. If you tell two adults they cannot date,
they will want to date even more. It creates a Romeo and Juliet effect.
Exactly. A ban just drives it underground.
And underground is where the risk lives.
Right. If it's underground, you can't manage the conflict of interest, you can't clean up the reporting line, and if the relationship goes south, the victim feels like they can't report harassment because they'll get fired for breaking the rule in the first place.
It traps them.
So total bans are a legal and cultural failure. The guide is very firm on this. You need a policy that is realistic, clear, and proportionate.
Okay, so if we can't ban it, how do we fix it? What's the silver bullet here?
Sure.
The dreaded D word. Telling on yourself.
It feels like that, but it is the only mechanism that works. The policy has to be, you can date, but you must tell us if there's a conflict.
But realistically, who is going to walk into HR and say, hey, just so you know, we had a really great third date last night?
That's the challenge, and that's why the framing of it matters so much. The guide really emphasizes that disclosure has to be positioned as protection, not punishment.
Explain that. What does that look like?
If I tell HR I'm seeing my direct report, HR's reaction shouldn't be, you're in trouble. It has to be, okay, thank you for telling us. Let's protect you both. We'll move the reporting line. We'll have someone else determine their bonus this year.
So it's a shield.
It's an inoculation. Once it's disclosed and managed, once you've recused yourself from making decisions about that person, nobody can accuse you of favoritism later. You've taken the weapon away from the gossips.
This leads to something I've heard called a love contract.
Mm-hmm.
The source kind of alludes to this. Is that a real thing?
It is, though we usually call it a consensual relationship agreement. It's basically a document where both people sign off, confirming a few things. One, the relationship is consensual. Two, they know the harassment policy. And three, they agree to behave professionally.
It sounds incredibly unromantic. Please sign here before we go to dinner.
It is possibly the least romantic document on earth, but legally, it's gold. If the relationship ends and one person claims, I was forced into this, the company can pull out that document they both signed. It doesn't solve everything, but it helps.
But this whole system only works if people feel safe enough to disclose in the first place. And this is the human element part of the guide. A policy is just paper.
Right. Culture eats policy for breakfast. You can have the best written handbook in the world, but if your culture is one of fear, nobody will use it.
The guide talks about the drift. I thought this was such a smart observation. Relationships don't just start with a declaration. They drift.
They do. It's rarely an overnight thing. It starts with a late night at the office ordering pizza. Then it's a text about the boss. Then it's a text about life. Then it's a drink. By the time a line is crossed, the couple often doesn't even realize it until they're deep in the danger zone.
So managers need to be trained to spot that drift.
Yes. Managers are the frontline sensors. They need to be trained to spot when a dynamic is shifting. They need to be able to have that awkward conversation and say, hey, I noticed you two are spending a lot of time together. Just a friendly reminder of our policy. Not to get you in trouble, but to keep things clean.
That is a very hard conversation to have.
It's incredibly awkward, but the alternative is waiting for the subpoena. The cool boss, who just winks and looks the other way, is actually exposing the company to massive risk.
The source also makes a point to mention retaliation protection. Why is that so specific?
Because fear of retaliation is the number one reason people stay in toxic workplace relationships. If I break up with my manager, will they fire me? Will they give me the worst shifts, block my transfer?
So the policy has to explicitly say you're safe.
It has to say in black and white. If you end a relationship or if you report one, you are protected from retaliation. That is the only way you get psychological safety.
It really feels like the goal here isn't to stop people from falling in love. It's to stop them from hiding it.
That is the perfect summary. The enemy isn't the romance. The enemy is the secrecy. Secrecy prevents the organization from managing risk. It breeds rumors. If you bring it into the light, you can actually deal with it.
So let's bring this home for everyone listening. Maybe you're the employee thinking, does this really apply to me? Or you're a boss thinking, do I really need to write all this down?
If you're the employee, you need to realize that these policies are actually your best friend. Yeah. They protect you from being accused of sleeping your way to the top. They protect you from bias. And honestly, they protect you from a vengeful ex-partner trying to tank your career.
And if you're the leader,
you have to model the transparency. You have to realize that ignoring it, that don't ask, don't tell approach, is just gambling with your company's reputation.
Better to have an awkward conversation now than a lawsuit later.
100%.
I want to leave everyone with a final thought that really stuck with me from the end of the guide. We spend so much energy trying to compartmentalize our lives. We have work me and real me, but the data and the psychology shows that's just impossible. We're the same person in both places.
We are. We bring our hearts to work whether we want to or not.
So the question isn't, how do we stop feelings at work? The real question is, are we mature enough as an organization to handle them with transparency when they happen?
That's the question every single person has to answer.